Welcome to No Royal Road, which is a project between Varmblog, which is me, and Half of Regrettable Century, which is the Brothers Regrettable.
What's up? Chris
here. How's
it
going? This is Jason.
And we are talking about historiography, which does not necessarily seem like the subject of either of our podcasts, and yet I think is crucial. The series, which will be of indefinite length because its topic is almost infinite, will be about understanding social technologies in cybernetic speak, or in Marxist speak, relations, modes of productions, and their intricacies. What we will not be doing on this show is going over Marxist text and explicating them for you. Instead, our goal is to take the knowledge and systems that we deal with in Marxist historiography, look at different areas of the past and the various ways they organize their society, what we might call social production and reproduction, look at the implications of what that means, and then actually try to draw that out for use for the way we talk about politics now. So this may seem, for many people, an arcane topic. It might seem a little bit more like listening to Mike Duncan with a bunch of Marx nerds than your normal Marxist podcast. But the goal here is not just to teach you the intricacies of Roman tax law, but trust me, it's going to come up.
Yeah, that's a bonus. Lucky you.
The goal here is to show you men, humans, make their history, but not of their own making.
Right. Yeah, I sort of think of it like, you know, we all agree and lament the pitiful state of everything before us. And it's about time to start figuring out how to think about it as more than just problems, right? Like, what is it rooted in? How do you theorize how to get through it? And it starts with an understanding of history.
Right. And I think that for us, this is a topic that's constantly comes up, is how do we understand transitions, right? And how do we talk about the future in a way that is realistic, right? And I think understanding transitions will help us talk about the future in a way that's realistic.
I think transitions in particular are interesting because you see how these are the moments where you see how the modes of reproduction really do modes of reproduction, modes of production and the relations of production. The way society reproduces itself, orders its political economy, really matters, because that's when you see the shifts. But what I find fascinating about this is that in almost all cases that I've looked at, you don't find clean evental breaks. Like, there is not a moment where everything changes all at once. You also don't find total continuity, although right now the historiographic trend outside of a few select Marxist thinkers, particularly in the US and Britain, is to focus on continuity going back in perpetuity forever, which sounds a little bit ridiculous, but there is a way in which the abandonment of big ideas about history, or big historiography, which really happened in the 1950s and 60s as far as the academic tradition, led to a focus on small historical facts and then the assumption of anthropological continuity. So people are basically the same as they've ever been, which is actually something that I don't totally disagree with as far as like humans as biological beings once you get like 10,000 years ago. But what I say that's interesting about that is that means that making statements about the meanings of what societies do or how they're structured, where law comes from, this, that, and the other, when you're focusing only on continuity, it makes it seem like everything that we have now conceptually goes back in perpetuity. And one thing I'll say, for example, critical race historiography, for example, is kind of actually decent on this, but a lot of other stuff is not. There's a tendency right now in classics, for example, to deny that there is anything analogous to the concept of race in the ancient world, which is not true. And we're not talking about Ed the Gay, but this is where it might show up in recent historical debates because everyone is focused on race in the academy right now. But there's also a tendency to try to apply quasi-biological race theory going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, which is frankly horseshit. I mean, I don't want to put it in too unvarnished of the term. It's not the way they understood themselves. There are words for skin types in ancient Greek. They're actually really, it doesn't come up. It comes up even less in ancient Rome, but it's not that important. The primary marker of ethnicity is your polis and your language.
Yeah.
Right.
Furthermore, the idea that your government is contiguous with your polis and your language after the end of city states is pretty much a modern phenomenon. So the idea of the nation state, where a nation, which is an ethnic group, has a consistent polity attached to it, that is something that develops out of England and France, in specific, actually, and then spreads throughout Europe, and really is historically situated with the beginning of bourgeois modernity. In the form that we know it right now. It is not that there were not ethnicities and peoples and nations, but it's hard even when you read religious texts from antiquity when they talk about universal ethnoi, like the church as the universe, because the word is the universe. The word in Greek is something like, to anglicize it a bit, something like Catholic ethnicity.
Yeah,
The universal ethnoi or the universal ethnic group, Christianity.
Yeah, like you would say Turks and Greeks to mean Muslims and Christians,
right?
As just like one of probably more examples, but that I think that one serves to illustrate the point enough. I do think, like, not that this is the main discussion, but it is important. Like, there is some sort of relative continuity between the concept of the tribe and tribal lands and the concept of the nation and the nation state. But the rupture between the two is also just as important. Like, reviving a classical idea and giving it an entirely new content is the project of the bourgeoisie, like from the republic to the nation as concepts.
Right. Well, let's think about that even further back. This is where our three back, and we should probably say our backgrounds. My background, believe it or not, is in literature and educational theory, but I do have education in anthropology. Chris's background is in history and historiography. I don't know your background, Jason, so you can tell.
Oh, yeah. Anthropology and history. That's my double major. But unlike both of you, I've been out of a school setting for many, many years now.
No, I haven't been an academic in a decade, so.
Okay. Well, so it's.
I'm back. I was almost out for a decade and then I went back because I'm crazy.
Right.
I do make an effort to keep up with what is being published in the anthropological journals that I would be reading if I were still a student, but it's not systematic.
So what I think is interesting, if we want to talk about relations of production, and then we'll go into the Wickham stuff in particular, and I'll let Chris introduce Christopher Wickham, or Chris Wickham. Is he Chris or Christopher? I don't ever remember.
Chris.
Okay, Chris Wickham. One thing I will say is a lot of these germs of ideas, and this is where I think this is actually a critique I have of, say, classical Bolshevism, for example. Classical Bolsheviks were absolutely right about the historical instantiation of the nation and why they thought it was progressive, but they thought that it would just go away by economic development.
Right.
Like, that was their doctrine. If once you develop economically enough, the need for these national groupings will just dissolve. When it didn't, well, then Russification happened. And so this has been a problem for us because these germs of ideas we're often right about their origin and specific instantiations. The big one that we would talk about here would be like symbolic kinship, literal biological kinship, symbolic kinship, which seems to develop in deep anthropology, according to Marshall Solins, almost concurrent with language. So as soon as we can speak, we have ways to take in non-bio members into our kinship group.
Yeah. I mean, arguably that's what it first serves to do.
Right. Then, which is also like just from a biological perspective, pretty smart, because if your primary social group is your kinship group and you're also breeding within that primary social group, you're going to quickly degenerate into a bunch of
new people.
Inbred problems. So yeah, you need new people and you need a way to conceptualize that. All right. The first symbolic kinship is probably it's to call it marriage is misleading, actually. When we get into other transitions and the one we're going to talk about today, this gets harder, right? But particularly we get into really deep history. But basically pair bonding, our group sexual bonding is the first kind of extension of symbolic kinship. And then it expands out and out until you have the concept of the tribe. Now, this is largely speculative because I don't know how the hell you prove this. Like, you can't find it from archaeological remains. It's right. Based off of patterns that we see in language development applied to the evidence that we see from archaeology when compared to modern hunter-gatherer tribes. But let's also put that out there that modern hunter-gatherer tribes cannot really be taken as analogous as sometimes like anarcho-primitivists or whoever might do.
Or like Engels wanted it to be.
Yeah, to ancient peoples. Well, yeah, I mean, Marxist did that. I mean, Engels is fascinating because Engels is like super interested in anthropology, right? But mm-hmm. He also is in a time period where the anthropology is like really shitty. like it's colonial explicitly. Marx and Engels had bio theories about ethnic groups that were not racial so much as geographic, but like you go back and read them now and you kind of want to laugh. It's only crucial to Engels, but Engels also gets a lot of stuff right. Deductively from the things that weren't bad in early anthropology, such as sex relations being probably the origins of a lot of division of labor. When we got into agricultural society, we have a lot of evidence for that.
Yeah.
Totally. And stuff like that. So, you know, I don't want to just be like, oh, Engels believed in stuff like Lemurians. So he was obviously an idiot.
Right. No, there's a reason why you have to read Engels as an anthropology student. It's right. Not just and it's not just like as a symbol of an old way of thinking. It's because of how intuitively correct a lot of it is.
Right. And the role of labor and the transition from ape to man.
Yeah.
Is like solid. And now like accepted anthropological theory.
Yeah. Barely debated.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's debated is Engels's assertion that the finger develops from labor because of Lamarckian genetics. Which, like, I don't want to get into the dialectics of nature too much today, but that book is maddening in that it's actually not nearly as stupid as even I thought it was, you know, when I first was introduced to it years ago. But then there are some people who try to make it 100% correct for current anthropology, which is also kind of laughably bad. But yeah. there is a way in which division of labor, development of labor does actually affect our physiology. And in fact, you can say that one of the reasons why human development has changed, one is that we have gone through what might be called extended infantilization, which just means we spend more of our life with adolescent character traits than historical apes did. And that's actually probably good. I mean, so that's like a larger focus on brain development, high sociality, relatively little territorial aggression internal to a group that, you know, the internal mm-hmm. external really matters. That's one thesis. But other than that, all of our evolution's kind of been outsourced to technology. And by outsourced to technology, I do not just mean outsourced to physical tools. I also mean outsourced to ways that we organize things like hunting bands, etc. And in fact, in some ways, my contention is, and I think this contention is both crucial to both cybernetic theory and Marxism, and I'm not claiming those are the same thing, that social structures and physical technologies are actually part and parcel of the same impulse.
Right. Like the struggle against nature leads to the class struggle, leads to the development of technology, and they're all part of a similar stream of processes, which we call evolution. And they all play a similar role, but they're all different.
Right. I also don't think they're unique to humans. Honestly.
No, that's exactly right. Right. That's why there are some people who say, theoretically, we could postulate that evolution may have a stalling out point mm-hmm. at a certain level of technological development where there isn't whatever, that it isn't expanding and thus changing us. I don't know what I think of that, but I at least see why a person might say that.
Before we transition to the topic of today, which is just historical transitions in the antique world, and by the antique world is my cop out way of naming Rome, early Islamic government, classical China, pre-Mughal India, etc. I call it, you know, I like to use the antique world because it's like, and Chris can speak this more than me. All these terms are totally debated, and the antique world is like the cop out. Like I'm just going to pick the one that offends the least number of people.
if we're specifically Wickham is focusing on what's considered even the late antique world,
right?
That way you don't have to say where early medieval begins and where classical antiquity ends. It's just that gray period. That's the late antique world. It's a few centuries on either side of it, and we won't argue about it.
But it's kind of like the long durée of modernity. These transition periods have long durées, right?
Right.
So, and part of what we're going to be doing today is taking the work of Chris Wickham, contextualizing it in the transitions from Rome. And we're going to focus on a couple essays over this series, but I think today we're going to focus on the comparative approach to historical transitions, which is, I would say, Marxist-ish as an approach. So what I mean by that is it is a Marxist approach based on Marxist modalities, but it is not one wedded to the first, second, or third international schema of historical development as pulled from basically a footnote from Marx and a footnote from Engels. I remember when I learned actually that Marx and Engels only mention like the five base modes of production like twice in all their writing, including their letters. And I was like, wait, so we developed a historical and dialectical materialism doctrine based off of a footnote?
Yeah, that's what happens when you need Marxism to be an all-encompassing theory of everything. Anything that isn't written about explicitly has to be found implicitly in a letter or a fragment of a, you know, like a napkin from a like a bout of drinking. Anything that the founders said, that's the theory. And that's
this does come from Capital, but the categories are basically the Adam Smithian categories, actually.
Yeah.
Like it's often forgotten that like Asiatic despotism was a problem. And I mean, we will eventually get into stuff around like this also comes from late antique, like tributary modes of production, which was the sort of Samir Amin answer to the problem.
Yeah.
But I think starting with this transition is super important because one valid criticism of Marxism's Eurocentrism is that it pulled from primarily European historiography.
Mm-hmm. Not even just European historiography, but a very specific area of Northwestern Europe.
Right.
Like Northern France, Great Britain, the Western German areas, where this very narrow view of what feudalism was held sway and either didn't or was mixed everywhere else.
So since Wickham's your guy, Chris, I'm going to let you introduce Chris Wickham to our audience.
All right. Well, Chris Wickham is a scholar of primarily early medieval and late antique Italy. He's a professor at Oxford and has been for a number of years and is, you know, he is clearly Marxist in his historiography and he's a member of the Labor Party. And before that, he was like a member of some Italian like one of the formations that came out of the breakup of the Italian Communist Party in the late 90s. He was actually a member of that party whenever he was living in Italy. So he's in our orbit, right? And he's a fellow traveler of ours. And his ideas about the transition to feudalism are very, I think, clear and concise and help to make sense of a lot of noise that I think a lot of arguments about the transition between the classical mode of production and the feudal mode of production seems to break down in a lot of minutia, arguing about finer points of this and that. Wickham's view is all encompassing and I think makes a lot of sense.
So we'll get to Wickham's view in a minute. What I find interesting about Wickham is I encountered him without any of that knowledge. I have two books for him that I think I got off of suggestion of a history professor who is not a Marxist, not even particularly political, and that is his two kind of semi-popular works, The Inheritance of Rome and Medieval Europe.
Right. His Inheritance of Rome book is essentially the popular version of his enormous Ethiopian Bible-sized tome that deals with the same subject matter, Framing the Early Middle Ages. That's what it's called. Europe and the Mediterranean from 400 to 800.
Oh, yes, that book, which yeah. I have attempted to read. and I just, was like, there's too many pages.
Just read The Inheritance of Rome.
Which is funny because when I say that, people are like, oh, Derek reads everything. And I'm like, yeah, but I only have so much time in my life.
And The Inheritance of Rome is actually on Audible right now, so you can even listen to it if you want to.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And it really is. I've read it through several times because my focus whenever I was in undergrad and the first few years of me being in graduate school was on medieval history with the focus on feudal and canon law. But I've since switched, but I haven't forgotten all the stuff that I learned. Just most of it.
You've since switched to something even more immediately practical.
Yes.
What are you studying now?
Interwar German political theory and ideologies. So,
no.
Yeah. Like the Weimar Republic and the...
Actually, that might be more immediately practical given the way things are going right now.
That's right. So the theory is basically that we will pass from a Weimar period into a fall of Rome period, and we need to understand both.
Right. Which, if you have listened to my recent monologue on Joseph Tainter, you might actually think that I believe.
It seems that way.
So
it's a useful way of talking about things, even if you don't mean it literally anyhow.
No, I also do think there's an overextension. It's part of the modernist myth that the modern republics are an extension of the ancient republics. And so we would have a parallel to, you know, our decline cycle will be compared to the Roman decline cycle, even though, as we discuss, our actual way of organizing our society is only tangentially and kind of formally a little bit related to how Rome was actually run as either a republic or as a republican empire or as an empire. And we're going to focus on the late empire part because, frankly, believe it or not, despite the fact we don't have as much cool and easy to read history writings that we do about Julius Caesar, we have a lot more archaeological evidence. We have a lot more economic and religious writing from that time period. People just ignore it. And there's lots to be learned there. And particularly when you start comparing these different late antique empires, because one thing we tend to forget, we tend to think of, I think probably because, again, our obsession with England and France of this time period is like, oh, it's a bunch of little semi-independent baronies. Right? Like it's Mercia and it's Essex and it's Wessex and it's Pictland and it's Scotland, and Scotland not being modern Scotland, and it's Northumbria and it's Saxony and it's Perry France and it's, you know, the Bourbon, whatever. But that's partly because it's not just that we have a Eurocentric view of history as taught, not just in the United States and in England, but partly as a resulting of the British Empire almost everywhere, is that we have a Northern European early consolidationist, early modern view of what the ancient world was.
Yeah.
So, you know, where it's like, oh, there's a bunch of little like feuding small states. They get consolidated in the big states, just like what's going on now in Prussia and in the Italian city states. Look at it. It's continuing process. We already did it here. This is what the ancient world is. And then you go back and read about this ancient antique world and you're like, wait, this is a bunch of empires.
Yeah.
And they're massive.
Yeah. The Gothic state in Italy essentially just lays hands to the infrastructure created by the Roman Empire and rules like a German-controlled little mini Roman Empire. And then, you know, the Visigothic state in Spain and the Frankish state or the you know, the where they refer to as the Frankish Empire or the Gaulish Empire.
Right.
And then the, you know, all of these little mini many empire polities ruled in the way that the Romans did to a certain extent, one way or the other. And those are like enormous states for the time.
Yeah,
and, right. They don't devolve into squabbling, you know, petty baronies for like another few hundred years. And even then, there's still some sort of like, I mean, we transition from this the Frankish state into the Carolingian Empire, and then after the fall of the Carolingian Empire, you start to like after 1000, you start to get the devolution of the Carolingian Empire into like the Holy Roman Empire,
right, the Holy Roman Empire into France.
Yeah,
but, yeah.
But
that's why I think it's useful. Like Wickham makes a case, not in the essay we're actually going to talk about, but he makes it elsewhere, that it's necessary to seek the continuities, but it's equally necessary to seek the ruptures, because if you don't, no,
that isn't an essay we were going to talk about.
Oh, great. Well then.
Well, you also that. Are reading The Inheritance of Rome at the same time you're reading this essay.
Yeah, I might just have them all mixed up.
This essay is essentially like a 35-page version of The Inheritance of Rome, which is like a 600-page version of the 900-page other versions.
It's important to be able to explain everything you know in as little as possible so you can go, you know, expand and contract. But so the point there is just that, like, you know, for all that I think we do think that Hegel is not right about in terms of just like the obvious progressive development of history and things are getting better all the time, there's something basically right about this idea that like there is a sort of a movement of history where there are things from the past that kind of get resurrected in a completely different form, because people only know what they know, so they do what they think that they already did. Of course they do it differently.
I mean, this is one of Marx's more Hegelian points that maintains, and it really doesn't come up in Capital so much as it comes up in the Brumaire. Like when I get annoyed with people LARPing past political movements, I have to remind myself that's the history of proto-political movements, is people LARPing past political movements. Like that's what they do. The issue is like thinking that that's where you're going to end up, but it's, I mean, you know, he points out, like, look, and the bourgeois revolutions in England, which are very, very incomplete. I mean, England never has land reform, never completely gets rid of its aristocracy, but they're play acting the Bible. And then he points out, and then like we go slightly ahead, and not just the Bible, but like the Old Testament, mm-hmm. and then the French are play acting Rome, and then like.
And well, they're really
play acting the last revolution too.
Well, so first the Carolingian Empire is play acting Rome, and then the French state is play acting the Carolingian Empire, and then the later Ancien Regime is play acting the earlier French state, which is play acting. Yeah,
the revolutionaries are play acting Republican Rome's Byron banishing of the tyrant. So it's like it comes full circle, right? Almost in a kind of mock way, you see this transition. What I also like about Wickham, because he pulls a lot from, and I have said this name about 85 different ways in my life because I've never actually heard it pronounced, even though I've heard this guy talk. Gyrus or Banerjee.
I've heard it said Banerjee.
Yeah. The Indian Trotskyist historian and historiographer who is also famous for nuancing modes of production in a big way. And also insisting that Marxists have to make intercultural comparisons to non-European societies and also settler colonial societies or, you know, post-European societies. Mm-hmm. And when they make claims and not try to fit all of world history into the Rome to medieval France to Republican France to full-blown capitalism model by making comparisons to the Mughal state, the Abbasid Caliphate, what actually happened in Nouveau Spain, etc. So Wickham also does this. Wickham makes a big deal of comparing and showing how these social technologies are different to different Roman societies. Also, what post-Roman societies, Romans going to insult everybody there, but post-Roman societies, one of which we think of as being non-Western, and that is particularly the Abbasid Caliphate are the early Islamicate empires.
Right. Well, which, and he he does point to like a similarities from basically Iberia all the way to China, like that there is, which I think it might, I might've just stole the point you were trying to make. So,
yeah, I mean, but he, so you can look at this, you can see both concurrence are, to not speak Marxist terminology for a second, to speak like general anthropological terminology, you can see concurrent or convergent development, convergent social development. But you also see that these small differences really matter. So, for example, in the comparison that Wickham makes between the Abbasid Caliphate and its collapse and the Carolingian Empire and its collapse, one of the things that's interesting is the Abbasids maintain the tax system of the Romans. That is their basis for how they fund their military expansion.
And they're the only ones that successfully do it for any period of time after the collapse of the empire, too.
Right.
Yeah.
And they are. And also the successor states of the collapsed Abbasids also maintain it. So that's, whereas the other systems fall into this manorial system where the army is largely unpaid in coin, it is no longer drawing a salary, literally where it comes, that term comes from.
Yeah.
They are now being paid in land rights, and that they're effectively an unpaid army. Now, this has all kinds of negative effects in Europe, like marauding bands of warlords effectively under the centralized power, cannibalizing its own countryside. But it's interesting because both of these states are effectively picking up social apparatuses, social reproduction, social technologies, ways of organizing the way you go through society from the Roman Empire, but they're picking up different elements of it.
Right. And contradictory elements of it.
Right. And it really changes the development of both regions, like massively. This is why you don't see as much seemingly technological loss. And actually, I will say in defense of this, late antiquity has less technological loss than we often claim it does from like Victorian historiography. Like,
right. Absolutely. In fact, I think that late antiquity pretty much for the most part seamlessly carries on the technologies of the Roman period into the Middle Ages. And then the Middle Ages are actually a much more dynamic and fruitful period of technological development than almost the entirety of classical antiquity.
Right. It's the way I've started to understand it. Cause my old understanding of it is the one that, you know, the fall of Rome means everybody forgets how to do things. Right. And it's really actually the
Enlightenment
fall,
propaganda.
Yeah. What it really is the absence of an imperial center to rationalize administration and infrastructure just means that you aren't building roads in between everything. Cause you don't need to fucking go everywhere like you used to have to. You aren't developing aqueducts that bring water from far away to here because the polities are smaller, their administration is smaller, their needs are smaller.
And the collapse of the tax system means the collapse of the infrastructure that is needed to maintain long distance trade. So long distance trade virtually disappears in the late antiquity and the early medieval period.
I do less stuff when I have less money, but it doesn't mean I don't know what stuff there is to do.
Right. I mean, also, you might like it. Let's say that, I mean, one of the things about this is it's not actually clear that all these provincial areas actually had less money or less. And let's not actually say money's a little bit deceptive here. While money does exist, this is not like a pre-monetary society. The coinage of the day is largely attached to gold, to land, and gold is used, and the minting of coins are used for two reasons. One is tax farming towards the king, and the other is international trade. And we know there's international trade because I'm like, and this blew my mind when I learned this 20 years ago. Like, you have gold coins being minted in Christian Europe as far north as Mercia, so we're in England, with Islamicate and Arabic writing on it that the people minting the coins probably do not understand because they're being minted for trade that can go down all the way to the various post-Abbasid Islamicate empires. That is not an isolated world. And yet, there isn't a lot of that international trade going on. So the infrastructure to maintain it just isn't there.
by comparison to the late Roman world, where you, I mean, the state was the engine of commerce, right? Mm-hmm. And large scale trade was organized by the state and then protected by the state. So when that state disappears, it's down to individual traders once again. It still happens, but it's on a much smaller scale.
Well, and if you're trading, yeah, if you're trading from the British Isles to the Middle East, but you don't have any interest in any of the places in between, you just sail a ship and you dock at ports, right? But whereas, like, when the imperial center is Rome and everything that all trade is being concentrated there, you actually have an interest in having roads connecting all of your provincial capitals to your imperial capital. It's really just a matter of, like, it doesn't actually make economic sense for kings in the British Isles to build roads through France down through Italy in order to trade with the Arab states. It's just an infrastructural need that they don't have.
And, well, even that, what they're doing is running ships and trading with the Carolingians, who are trading with the Byzantines,
yeah,
who are trading,
yeah,
with the richer Arab states. So it's, you're running infrastructure indirectly through sailing. You're completely right about that. And then you're also no longer centralized. So you're like, okay, the biggest trader that I'm going to be dealing with is probably the Abbasid Caliphate. They're infidels, but, you know, who cares? I don't know much about those Mohammedanians down there. And we don't even have, this is another thing, like, this is a time period at in England and France where, like, the battles to who can control the printing of coins for international trade is an open battle, because, like, bishoprics, for example, would occasionally mint their own coin, which would never have happened in the Roman imperial state.
Oh, definitely not. No.
Right. So, like, one of the things that you see during this time period, and this is where I bring in my knowledge of systems theory, is that the old imperial apparatus was in many ways hyper fragile. It was already fragmenting to some of these things on its own to survive during the Diocletian period.
Right.
And the Diocletian reforms. And what you see come out of that are a bunch of polycentric, inefficient, but very resistant systems. So you have both the empires. But then we haven't mentioned this, and this is crucial to this time period in the West, but you have the unification of the church and the idea of Christendom, which ties all this together tangentially.
Right? And is actually, like, after the Western Empire collapses, survives as a skeleton organized along the lines of the late empire, and then is the center for power, center for creating power around the bishoprics in many instances.
Yeah, and so this is also true for political economy. Before the development of our modern illusions about the separation of politics and economics, you cannot talk about politics and economics as separate in the late antique world, because the state is crucial to trade and is crucial to social technologies. But what's also interesting about that is that devolves or breaks down, devolves may be the wrong word, over time into multiple systems that are somewhat resilient and somewhat continuous, even though the modes of general economic production are changing.
Mm-hmm.
So this continuity and difference at the same time is super vital. And I think this is important for a lot of, like, misconceptions of Marxism. Marx doesn't talk about this very much, but this framework actually does kind of come up in the Critique of the Goethe Program. Now, you can have all kinds of Marxological debates about what the Critique of the Goethe Program actually means. For example, the division between communism and socialism is only kind of sort of stated there. It is in nowhere else. There's some other things. So it's unclear whether it's a totally imminent critique or not. But one of the things that Marx makes clear, that even in his revolutionary forms of socialism, in the beginning, there are still elements of the prior society. So there's still elements of bourgeois society in the beginning of socialism there. It is unavoidable. And I think Marx is intuiting what we now see in studying these transition periods.
Right.
There's structures left over from the prior society and all these other societies, but pretending like ancient Rome is the Carolingian Empire, is the French state, is totally misleading.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the difference is just consciously managing a transition, which is a unique political project for Marxism. Everybody else mm-hmm. just unconsciously went through mm-hmm. transitions. So like the, you know, the Marx talks about the era of the bourgeoisie in its scant 200 years. And he says that in the 1840s. So he's talking about, you know, going back into a period when there is no such thing as capitalism. And so by the time you have a thing that we recognize as industrial capitalism and a proper capitalist class, there's no sense that we did this on purpose, mm-hmm. but it very inexorably happened as a result of a rising class. I do think that that's a lot of why we have such a difficult time theorizing our own necessary transition of our own time, because we're the first ones to have to do it consciously.
Right.
And one of the nightmare scenarios that I like to remind everyone that's possible is that we might not do it consciously. Like capitalism yeah, right. may end and we not all die. I mean, that's also a strong possibility, but it's not.
We might not be that lucky.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, some of us really hope that, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen.
We have seen modal changes on law, and this is something that Marxists have not been great on, but we've seen modal changes on law and distinctions within capitalism. Like, the Long Depression led to major changes in the relation of capital to the state. The Great Depression led to major changes in relation to capital to the state. Neoliberalism led to even more changes of capital to the state. Like, neoliberalism was both a political project and the result of decline in profitability in my reading of the timeline.
Yeah.
Similarly, if you go back and look at the ancient past, you find similar ad hoc shifts in modality. So the importance of provincial administrators in the Roman Empire be increased as the Roman Empire is too scattered, but also has weaker and weaker coinage, etc. Like, its ability to compel international trade outside of its political boundaries gets harder and harder as its coinage gets more and more debased. The debasement of coinage doesn't matter internal to the empire. It matters external to it.
Something I had meant to say, and I forgot, and it's very much not germane to our discussion now, but the point you made about LARPing the past, mm-hmm. I think is really, really important. But there's another piece to it, which is everybody else we're referencing there is they're like speaking in a language that makes sense to people around them. So they're LARPing things that people would want to experience.
Whereas
we're like pretending like we're going to do the Russian Revolution again, and the average American doesn't want that. Whereas they might want the American Revolution again, or they might want the Civil War or Reconstruction again, maybe. But they certainly don't. You know, when you're LARPing 1917, you're not speaking a common language.
Well, it's also like you're LARPing something that is not particularly relevant to your current situation at all. Right. But I would say, like, the analogy to the American Revolution actually doesn't really make sense. And I'm also not sure that it truly appeals to most of the American people anymore either.
No, I think it did up until the period we're living in now, where we're just so far away from it, a connection to mass mobilization. So, which means we've lost our connection to everything that's ever informed anybody before. But like in Martin Luther King's speeches, you can still see like references to the promise of America and the founders and the project they started, and that still resonated with people. But now, I think you're probably right. Now, I don't think it does.
Yeah, there's a variety of reasons for that. I mean, but I think, yeah, it's, if anything, with the moment we're in right now, is we want to condemn all the past entirely, for good and ill. And there, I think we can find plenty of historical time periods that are analogous to that too, where you turn on a recent period of your own past as a way to establish something else. But what I would say in our current political debates and comparing them to like ancient Rome, which I actually think there's an essay by Umberto Eco that talks about how post-90s, post-neoliberal modernity really does in many ways not rhyme with ancient Rome, but rhyme with the early medieval period, despite the fact of mass communication in a global system, which I think is kind of a stretch. But I do think the idea that basically the only thing holding a lot of these empires together is commerce and a vague sense of morality that we might call human rights or something, which no one can really define or set out, which, you know, again,
kind of like Christianity in the early Middle Ages. There's a bunch of versions of it, not just the Arian heresies and stuff, but even like the Bulgar Orthodoxy versus the Greek Orthodoxy.
Right.
But there's some loose connection.
Even the Catholic Church has to have like really wildly divergent suborders within it to maintain its unity, which is something I've always pointed out. Like,
yeah,
the Franciscans have to be incorporated, otherwise there's going to be a breach in the church. I mean, honestly, if we're completely honest, stuff like the incorporation of certain Gnostic elements did happen in in the church. It's what Pauline parts are about. It's when the church couldn't do that anymore is when you started seeing the tendency towards the Protestant Reformation. But also, that is in the context of consolidation of actually strong, centralized states with a common language and the attempt at a common confession.
Right, which is to say the Catholic Church as a universalist program isn't politically necessary for states anymore, for ruling classes.
Yeah,
which is when you see the Protestant Reformation really begin in earnest. The ideas of the Protestant Reformation have been contained, but not just within heretical Catholic groups, but also in non-heretical ones, such as the Jansenists and the Augustinians. So, I mean, the Jansenists become heretical, but they don't start that way.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Their hard double predestinarianism, though, is like...
It's Calvinism in the Catholic Church, though, which is interesting.
It is funny how much of the Reformation is just certain branches or certain internal divisions in Catholicism striking out on their own. Like the connection between Erasmus and Luther is almost direct. It's just a political experience that causes Luther to go outward. And he doesn't start outward, right? He starts as a reformer in the church. Mm-hmm. It's just that that's just not the best way to do it anymore.
It's the same with Jan Hus as well.
Yeah.
Like Jan Hus is just a reformer, but then gets burned and a bunch of people die as a result.
It's kind
of
like what happens in the Socialist Party. Certain tendencies are problematic. You just got to get rid of them. They go start their own universal church.
Right. but I would also say the things that we have to do is look at the underlying social reproductive element of all these issues. Like, because the one thing I will say that I have thought that Marxists have not done a good job of, and again, we can make an analogy to our not understanding the transition from antiquity to feudalism, maybe even what feudalism is, and I'll let Chris speak to that more specifically in a minute, because it really is your field, but there is a way in which also in these religious disputes, like we talk about the Protestant work ethics and the origins of capitalism or whatever, there is a real sense in which Protestant social reproduction changes things in the economic sense. And even, and I think you, Jason, I point out that Plekhanov points this out, that like, despite it being double predestinarian, it actually has a very voluntaristic view of how to build community that honestly, if it was not tied into such a religiously repressive apparatus, we probably would not see as negatively as we see it now, given that it was relatively egalitarian for any of the Christian movements at the time, and also built on intentional community. Although this is also, you know, interesting, and you know, more some of the left communist historiography will go into this, is also true that you start seeing the seeds of communism in some of these movements and around anti-baptism, around the more radical, you know, the Church of the Free Spirit, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's the part. That's the part that Kautsky does get right in his histories of the period.
Right. But they're suppressed by the bourgeois elements who see them as taking this radical egalitarian element way, way too far. Conversely, in the Puritan experiments in North America, the distinction becomes not so much, yes, they're trading, and yes, there's land disputes, and yes, there's petty, you know, post-yeoman petty bourgeois shit going on. But there's also the sense that some of this is maintained by the hostile outsider reviewing the indigenous peoples as literal satanic forces on a plane stopping you from having your ideal egalitarian community. Which then manifest internal to the group and like witch hunts and stuff after like the early, like, was it Prince Henry's War or whatever? Those early wars, with the indigenous groups in New England end. That we have problems with this transition and how complicated it is in recent history. No wonder we have problems understanding ancient history. Yet, if there are theorists of bourgeois culture that come before the bourgeois, they are reinterpretations of ancient history. And that's something we have to deal with. Like, the reason why Marx has to spend, I mean, Marx has some Aristotelian philosophical traits, but the reason why Marx has to spend so much time at Aristotle is Aristotle is used by a lot of these bourgeois thinkers as the grounding for how they should start to organize trade, to answer questions Aristotle could not answer about trade.
Right. You can see how that feeds into a notion in contemporary historiography of basically everything always being as it was, but just more so.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could see there's an unbroken telos from time immemorial to now. And the most vulgar version of that, which I think shows why that's wrong, right, is that you can look at the American Revolution as a tax revolt, basically a conservative movement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if everything is all is just there's the state and there's commerce and there are people who are trying to be free by engaging in commerce, and that's on display in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, it's also on display now. It destroys your ability to operate in the world effectively, not just to understand history, but to make history.
Right. Or you can see the American Revolution as a land grab against native peoples, against a progressive empire protecting those native peoples.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
that's become a common left historiography, which is weird because it's like defending British settler colonialism against other forms of settler colonialism.
It applied some constraints, which is essentially like a bourgeois liberal argument.
Right.
And so too is this understanding of history.
Exactly. It's a bourgeois liberal argument in favor of an empire that has a king.
Yeah. Right. And the empire that, you know, brought all the slaves to the continent in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'm just, you know, and also didn't like magically get rid of it and most of its imperial holdings until about 50, 60 years later.
Yeah. Not until it was economically, you know, more viable to not let anyone else have slaves.
Right.
So
by the existence of the Royal Navy in this expanded state.
And also, this also ignores the fact that the revolt itself could have been compelling a lot of the more progressive policies towards Native Americans, as it did in their conflicts with the French and the French, the French Indian Wars. So one thing that we learn in this kind of historiography is don't moralize it. Yeah. Assume all sides are venial and self-interested. Just assume that. And
save yourself a lot of like hard thinking if you just acknowledge that from the very outset.
Yeah, you'll save yourself a lot of hard thinking that isn't productive. Because hard thinking can be, but this is not.
No, yeah, yeah.
Right. And mental gymnastics to justify this, that, or the other in this other counterfactual that your current historiography does not want to deal with. You know, and it's easier to do this, and this is actually a benefit of studying what Wickham's talking about. It's easier to do that with these ancient Islamicate and post-Roman and early medieval empires because we don't have a connection to moralize them about.
Right.
Even though we might be like, well, they're Christians and those other people are Muslims or whatever. I mean, you know, and you see that in like people not recognizing how much of the Arab caliphates are based not just on Arab tradition, but explicitly on the Roman Empire and on Greek Greek social customs that they inherit and Islamify.
I mean, I didn't know until reading Wickham that I didn't realize. And it makes sense now, but the ways in which like the Syriac Christian Orthodox Church and the Coptic Church, the reasons they survive is because they are crucial because of their existing scholars and administrators and so on, basically held over from the Roman period. They're crucial for the maintenance of the caliphate it's in the Abbasid period, I guess, but whatever. So it's like, you know, yeah, the
there's no incentive to get
Muslims.
Rid of them.
Right.
I mean, actually, weirdly, Fukuyama, of all people, Francis Fukuyama, in his Social Order and Social Decay 2 books, talks about this, that the Janissary system, which is a late form of this, but like the Demi system, is actually practical in that you have an elite that can have a counter elite serving it that is not in competition with that centralized Arab Muslim elite. And thus you have an administrative class that is loyal to its locality, but it's subservient to you, but is not in competition to you. And yeah. that's important.
Yeah.
And
that survives all the way into the 19th century.
It gets more and more elaborate in like the Janissary form and this, that, and the other. But it's also important for like, for example, the establishment of modern Egypt and its ruling as an independent polity is done by an Albanian. Just
right, know, right. Like, well, I was thinking the parallel that I'm most familiar with would be probably something like the Grand Duchy of Warsaw and Polish troops in the Grand Armée, who are like absolutely subservient to Napoleon, but are fighting for Polish interests against the Russians.
Right. I think this is important for understanding that. And it's easier for us to deal with this in the antique period, because with the exception of maybe Charlemagne, because Charlemagne becomes like, and actually not for us as Americans, I think as modern Europeans might have a bigger connection to this.
Yeah.
But
the grandfather of Europe.
We don't have as an immediate direct connection to these ancient groups, mm-hmm. even though genetically speaking, they probably are our direct ancestors if we are from European heritage. Like, I'm sure some of us have, you know, if like I am a, like I have Sephardic Jewish heritage, I'm sure I have Visigoth in me somewhere. But that's so far back, even though stupid, useless genetic tests can't prove it. So like,
right.
That history is deep. And so it's easy. But because of that, we also don't feel the need to moralize it in the same way, except for maybe that, oh, the Visigoths were Christians and the people who invaded were Muslims. And so, but I think even that's so distant now that.
I think there is I don't think this is super popular, but I know it exists to some degree that there is a, because of this desire to transhistoricize, like basically American race relations mm-hmm. as a global and eternal phenomenon. There mm-hmm. are some people who see like the Islamic invasions, like the Moorish invasion of Spain as like, that's good because the Moors are people of color and the Spaniards are white people. Or like the barbarian invasions of Rome is like, that's good because that's like, you know, small communal identity versus the big imposing empire. Because with,
but the big imposing empires of color and the small communals would not be by their standards, even though none of this makes any sense.
Well, that's the point, right? None of it actually makes any sense.
Or there's the idea that the Visigoths were Aryan heretics and the Muslims were God's scourge upon them. So like they don't have anyway.
Yeah. But yeah, generally speaking, like 80% of the time, I would say, like, well, I would even say 100% of the time when it comes to being really serious about history, you're right. Studying this period allows us to, we're far enough away that we don't have to find an analog. Whereas, like, you know, everyone's still trying to either be the Bolsheviks or be the German social democracy, or they're trying to, you know, embody the Jacobin tradition or whatever it is.
Also, like,
nobody's doing that for this.
What the Bolshevik experience is only four generations back for us, really.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it becomes clearer when I think about the fact that, like, the Espée Day and Debs is in Wilson's time. And, like, I have family members that I met that were alive in that time. They were, like, three, but were alive in right. that time period. So
right,
and
right.
they're dead now, you know, and I'm 40, but there are people that I met in my early childhood who would have remembered at least the aftermath of the Wilson period.
Sure. And like nominally, there's still an IWW, right? Or whatever.
Right.
Or like yeah, right. Whatever. All I mean to say is you can imagine that connection very easily. The SWP was founded by people who went through the experience of founding the Communist Party, and that group still exists. So there is a tenuous, but real continuity, or at least one that you can reasonably imagine yourself to be a part of or to have an emotional reaction to.
And that's just not true here. It's the Democrats and FDR.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Even though understanding that has been, I think understanding that time period in American history is almost impossible because everyone nostalgically identifies with a faction of it, even though they shouldn't.
Right, because it means everything to it means something to everyone, and it means something right. different to everybody.
Like, if you're a conservative, it's the downfall. It's the beginning of the entrance of communist ideas into the American state for some conservatives. If you're an old Dixiecrat, it's, you know, social welfare, but exclusionary for blacks, even though it's also how blacks entered the Democratic Party. If you are a black Democrat, it's why you change sides from. Mm-hmm. Historically speaking, from the Republicans to the Democrats. And so when you look at these ancient things here, it feels far away. But then when we talk about stuff about this ancient world, like the effects of tax policy on the stability of the state and the stability of the army, that feels very modern to people. And they think we're being weird when we're talking about it in terms of the ancient world. But it's crucial to understanding the empire, you know, and it's also crucial to understand that, like, kinds of money, for example, most money is coinage historically, because coinage is useful for external trade. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, debt, you know, you're reading the works of Michael Hudson, you realize that, like, oh, like, but paper money has been good, and debt and credit is how things work internally, and that is not on the same reason logic. But you have to understand these trades in the ancient world for stuff to make sense. And if you try to approach, I don't know, like, let's talk about modern monetary theory and try to read the ancient world in terms of, like, well, but the state can just print the money and compose it. I'm like, well, they can internal to themselves. But there's no empires remotely strong as a modern nation state. Like, this is another thing people don't understand, that, like, even the most strong central governments, you know, which would have been France and Britain, are not strong by modern standards.
No, like, on any terms, whether it's like the existence of a border or the ability to impose, like, a uniformity of language or a uniformity of laws or even the ability to collect taxes.
Right.
It's just like they're just much less equipped.
So I just got done reading this book about the conflict between Charles II and Parliament in Charles trying to build a standing army. And he's essentially just neutered at every single turn by Parliament. And that leads to the creation of a really crappy standing army. Like, the early British army was really weak, really underfunded, and had no training. And anyway, so, like, This is the strong early modern state, and they're trying so hard to balance between monarchism and republicanism that they're just a complete mess. It's lucky they're an island, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's almost like this is where I do say there is some truth to the geographic limitations of history, because like, Russia could not have gone through this. It just could not have done it. Like,
no, not at all.
Like, no, the Moscovy state couldn't have done it.
Well, right. The experience of the Golden Horde proves that. That's what happens whenever you're in that weakened of a state.
The only way that the British Army was ever able to get the experience and training that it needed was by hiring its soldiers out as mercenaries to other countries. And they brought all that back because they were unwilling to, like, establish an officer corps and have, like, you know, professional soldiers. It's ridiculous that the British Empire eventually, like, a century later, ends up controlling the biggest empire in the world.
Well, you know, that one bit right there, that gives all the lie necessary to what Wickham is tilting against with the kind of contemporary mainstream British historiography, which establishes a perpetual continuity, because the British officer corps is, like, part of the pride of the empire. And it didn't used to exist at all. So there's one simple rupture that is just, it's really easy to look at.
The idea that the British officer corps is, like, a good thing, the lie is put to that, like, a number of times throughout history, not the least of which being World War I.
Oh, yeah. Which was,
where General Haig is like shoveling 20,000 bodies into the maw at Passchendaele, like in a few days worth of fighting to gain a couple miles worth of territory. Yeah.
I guess if you're going to lie about your current moment, you can also lie about your history.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, well, this actually does affect things, and this is why understanding this ancient history may be good for analogous stuff now too. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about there has been a central tendency in Bolshevism to organize this party structure on the military structure and organize this military structure on the Prussian central staff. Mm-hmm. And that has been asserted as, like, the fundamental proof of centralization from Lenin going back, like, and is asserted now. I hate to tell people this, but if you study the U.S. military, that's absurd. Like, the U.S. military is not centralized in that way. There is no central staff. And the central staff, while it wasn't able to invent stuff like the Blitzkrieg and like the Hitlerian times, was also notoriously, like, Germany should have won World War I and was winning World War I. Mm-hmm. And it was the effects of the central staff plus some of Germany's locale and its lack of imperial resources that caused it to lose. And so there are ways in which even Marxists, even good, smart Marxists politically, have held on to these things because the Prussian Central Command was probably the most advanced military form after the Napoleonic form for forever, but it isn't anymore. There are other and more robust forms, more tactical forms to look at. Now, when we look at that also in the ancient world, we see that in the way that, like, there is a core of even, like, knights, like the knight structure in the early medieval, late antique time period is based partly off, like, cavalry aristocracy from Rome and develops kind of independently of that. But it could have, you could have developed, you know, a fighting force in a different way. And we see people pick that up from other technologies, social technologies of Rome, other social formations in other places. So like the paid relatively egalitarian, I said relatively, but relatively egalitarian, although technically slave army of the Islamicate empires were way, way more stable and more structured. Because instead of picking up on this aristocratic horse cavalry thing, they picked up on like the legion element of it, even though they use cavalry technologies and were not limited to like the shield, the shield technologies, the shield sword technology of the Roman legion. So I think that's important. This all matters. And to understand the modern world, it is usually good to start comparing it to parts of the ancient world and not assuming that the ancients were idiots and that they were so far undeveloped than us that it says nothing to modern state development, etc. Particularly in an era which you have synthetic nation states. So while the nation state is also a modern notion, the settled colonial nation states are all synthetic, like from the standpoint of nation state. Now, in reality, all nation states are synthetic. Meaning like you have to impose you have to pick a regional dialect, you have to impose it by education, you have to try to erase cultural differences between groups within the nation. It always amazes me that Americans insist, for example, that this is something that Europeans had done long ago. And while that's true for France, they'll say it for countries like Germany, Italy, and Spain. And I'm like,
which in like in Italy, it's still barely true. And in Spain, it's just not true.
Yeah. Right. Like in Spain, it never was successful. In Italy, it's fragile. The League of the North is for a region. Like there's a reason why all these modern, supposedly old cultures have weird fragmentary states in all of them.
Yeah.
That would culturally branch off if they could at any time.
And then if you look at Germany, the existence of Germany, Austria, Luxembourg, Switzerland, which are all culturally, like almost culturally identical regions that speak the same language that are all divided by what?
Right. And there's also big cultural differences between parts of Germany. Like, but the Bavarians barely believe that they're Germans or that they're the true Germans and everyone else is, you know, I'm overstating.
Like, Bavarians are essentially exactly the same as like Austrians.
Right, right. It's the Prussians and the Hanoverians who are like distinct, but like okay, so this is to connect it to an earlier conversation. There is an obvious continuity which allows for these synthetic nation states to be deeply felt. Because if it was purely synthetic, they wouldn't buy it. But those like tribal cultural inheritances are there across all of these different.
But for example, the idea that the U.S. is the only ideological nation state, which is a lot of U.S. both conservatives and liberals believe, right? That there were two ideological nation states. The USSR was one. The U.S. is the other. The USSR is gone. The U.S. still exists. But at this point, I don't think we can say that U.S. identity is ideological. It is national. Oh, and yeah, it's national. Based on a shared culture and shared language and sometimes a shared race, although that goes in and out depending on a bunch of external conditions.
Yeah. Actually, the ideological element of U.S. identity is the weakest one. It's the thing. Mm-hmm. What does it even mean? Nobody knows. Nobody even has.
What's the ideology? Is it freedom?
That's the thing people actually lament when they look at the state of the American subject is actually it is a non-ideological.
Like, yeah, it is a bunch of gusts of popular sentiment. It is not programmatically or ideologically unified in any way, form, or fashion. While I would say that, like, compared to Europe, we were less given to blood and soil stuff and a bunch of other things. And people are like, well, the sort of colonials, blood and soil. Yeah, it was racist, but it wasn't blood and soil because we knew we didn't come from here. Although there were attempts in the 18th century to make it blood and soil with, like, weird anthropology, but it never took.
I would say that, like, if we're looking back at ideological nation states, you could probably consider Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia to be ideological nation states. Like, ethnicities that are all bound together by civic nationalism as opposed to, like, you know, ethnic nationalism.
But it's also interesting in that when you look at Central Europe, ethnic nationalism is synthetic, with maybe the exception of Poland, because until the great sorting of peoples after World War II, those areas were never ethnically homogenous.
No, right. Not at all. I mean, like I think my aunt did, who is 100% Czech, did her DNA ancestry thing. Turns out she's like 40-something percent German.
That totally makes sense.
And I was like, yeah, of course. It's because we're Bohemian and Moravian. So your Bohemian side is just German, I guarantee you. The fact that they speak Czech is, you know, it's such an ethnically homogenous area. It's like, when you look at Poland, Germany, and the Czech Republic, you're going to find German names that have been Czechified or whatever the
Slavified,
Polishized, yeah. Whatever, and vice versa, like all over the place. You know, slight like the name like Nimitz, like you know Admiral Nimitz from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Czech version of his name that's also Nimitz, just spelled differently. And
so my last name apparently is a French corruption. Oh, it's an English corruption of a French corruption of a Bulgarian Hungarian name.
Yeah.
So like it goes from something I don't really know, and then it shifts over to Varnadu. So it probably means like something related to Varna in Bulgaria.
That makes sense.
Becomes Varnadu. In France becomes Varnado and then just Varn in the United States. So like, who knows? Who knows where like other than that there's some Jewish heritage, we actually don't know like, okay, so you were a Slavic family in exile in medieval France that somehow ended up with Dutch colonists in the United States. But that is the history of Europe.
I was reading about Slovakia the other day. Mm-hmm. And the of course you go back far enough, all the Slavs are like the same ethnic group, right?
Mm-hmm.
But even the difference between Moravians and Slovakians is only a couple hundred years old.
Well, except for the Bulgarians who and the Hungarians who may not be Slavs.
That's true. So, yeah. But the difference between Moravians and Slovakians is only a couple hundred years old, and there's like this dividing line which parts of the Austrian Empire fell under the Hungarian domination and which parts fell under the German domination, right? So this group is artificially chopped off and stuck on the Austrian side, and that's the Moravians, and then the rest of them are Slovakians. So Moravians and Slovakians are the same people, just like this artificial dividing line between Cislithania and Translithania, which is interesting, has nothing to do with gender at all, but are the two halves of the Austrian Empire.
This is why... Right. Just to thinking about something that we said early on, this is why so many of the Marxists in the classical era, in the Second International era, and really into the Third International era, just presumed all of this would disappear with economic integration and sophistication, because it's like, you know, fake. And in one sense, it is fake. Right. And in another sense, it's not at all, because it's something that's deeply felt is real, even if it's not true.
Imagine communities build social infrastructure, affect social reproduction. Mm-hmm. And affecting social reproduction become materially real.
That's what it means to be Roman. It means to have fallen under the domination of Roman administration, which is just a thing people decide to do. And so I'm Roman now. And that you know, artificial construct, because you know, it's very fun. It's very, the way that people talk about everything now is like, oh, that's just a social construct, as if that explains anything. It's like, is there anything that's not a social construct? Everything we're talking about is social construct, but social constructs are real. The Romans marched around and conquered everybody, made them Roman. And ever since, we've been trying to figure out how to keep being Roman, even though we haven't been Roman for a very long time now.
And some people like say the Romano-British were never actually Roman and just adopted mm-hmm. some of their ways and messed their language up. Or made it cooler, depending on what you want to
expect. Whichever side you're on.
I studied Latin, and I can't read Welsh, so I'm going to say
that's true. But whereas I study Latin, and I can kind of figure out Romanian.
Oh, so, yeah. Romanian is probably the closest thing to Latin that's still spoken.
Ironically, actually, but yeah. So it's like...
Well, that's an interesting story, too. Like, why is there a pure version of the Latin... the purest version of the Latin language that exists in Eastern Europe? It's
right.
Because of the first large-scale genocide ever committed by a European nation when the Romans, like, depopulated the Dacians from Romania.
Although there is a lot of Romanians who think that they might have genetic Dacian heritage and that the genocide was never thorough.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that like they didn't literally kill all the Dacians, but they definitely destroyed their centers of ethnic identity and outbred.
It's really them. It might be slightly more accurate to refer to it as a forced assimilation or even an ethnic cleansing rather than a genocide.
Yeah, well, probably. Yeah, except that the United Nations definition of genocide actually includes not just ethnic cleansing but even cultural erasure.
Right, yeah.
So, it's one of those things where, like I won't mention the specific controversy because I don't want to get in it, but certain nation states in certain parts of the world who are engaged in nation building things are being accused of genocide, and it is technically true under UN conventions because they are engaging in cultural assimilationism and maybe even population control, but they are not actively killing people. So it's a different, and I'm being very vague because what I'm saying actually will probably piss off every side in that debate, but it is technically true that the way that genocide is defined by the UN, that would count. But that's not what we mean in common language when we say right. the word genocide. We mean wipe out to a person.
Yeah.
But this is an interesting train period to get us back to Wickham, because this is where things are also changing in this consolidation of national identities that really, like, the ethnic identities that do make up the kind of DNA of the European identity in Western Europe, not in Eastern Europe or Central Europe, in Western Europe, from the west half of Germany to about the top of Italy. We're going to exclude Spain from this because that's different conditions. Emerges from the transfers of ethnic groups intermixing and consolidating into national languages and cultures in this time period for the purposes of national administration. And it is not an accident that the most consistent form of this is on a fucking island. And even it's not that consistent, because English identity is still kind of precarious to this day. Are Northerners really English? Or, you know, like, you know, they're not Scottish, they're not above the wall, but those people from Northumbria, they're a little bit hicky.
Well, I mean, and that's probably has a lot more to do with the later part of the early medieval period and the establishment of the Dane law. And
The establishment of the Dane law, the fact that there were still a whole lot of Romano-British in that area too. Mm-hmm. And while they assimilated to, actually, everybody assimilated to Anglo-Saxon customs. This is one of the things recent genetic studies, they did not wipe out the Anglo-Saxons didn't even remotely wipe out the local Romano-British populations. What they did was just assimilate them culturally.
Right. Well, it's one of the things I've learned recently is saying Anglo-Saxon is apparently a cancelable offense now. I don't remember what it is that you're supposed to say, but Anglo-Saxon is supposedly 19th century terminology that was invented to give the British a race to be proud of.
And to tie them to the Germans in some way. Like, yeah.
I mean, we could call them the Anglo-Saxon, Danish, Frisian,
German-speaking settlers who destroyed the Romans, whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
I mean, Germanic is a useful enough.
Personally, I'm not bothered by it. I like, there are things that were racist whenever they were invented that like fucking aren't anymore because they're completely divorced from their context.
Well, it's like people who talk about proto-Indo-European studies being inherently racist because it has some roots in Aryan hypothesis. Like, but
there's a common language. It's fucking, it's a demonstrable fact that there is such a thing as a Proto-Indo-European language. So fuck off.
That's basically right.
Yeah. Even though it has it's even though the discovery of Proto-Indo-European culture and language, whatever.
It's based off the Aryan racial hypothesis.
Right, exactly. Yes.
I mean, if we had to wait for all truths to come from good people, we'd have a big fucking problem.
Yeah, exactly.
But even in regards to Marxism, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, we've been kind of far ranging. I think our next episode will be more centered in on the specific Wickham thesis. But I do think this problem of antiquity, when you start doing comparisons to stuff, even in recent history, really starts to illustrate that what we mean by modes of production and how they change are not discrete events.
Mm-hmm.
A revolution is not a discrete event, but you can go with this in another way. Like, I think Kalski, for example, intuits this, but then his answer to it is just to make a revolution mean accelerated force of change, which I don't know that that's meaningful. And also, one thing that we're going to have to deal with on another episode is, when is something revolutionary and when is something just the results of another formation, a social formation being no longer viable, i.e. it slowly collapsing? Like, I mean, because, for example, I actually think it's a miracle that the Western Roman Empire actually even got out of the 3rd century.
Right? Oh, yeah. The crisis was deep, and it was complete chaos. It's like, it's funny to read about it, and then, because whenever you're reading about it in a linear fashion, chronologically, you're like, oh, this is when the Roman Empire collapses. And then it keeps going for 2 more centuries.
Right. Like, if you just, like, do a Wikipedia, like, follow the Roman Empire, it gives you like 6 dates. Yeah. And they all take place within the West. And then you got to remember there's also an East, and it has its own fall. And that also has like 3 or 4 dates. Periodization schemes are useful, but they're not exact. And I think that there is a growing tendency to try to throw them out because of that. So I think people want everything to be exact and neatly contained. Because the overlap of, you know, the coexistence of two like modes of production or two methods of administration or whatever, or the intermixing of ethnic groups, that bothers people.
In critical history around modern monetary theory, where they want to argue that there is a continuity going all the way back to like ancient Mesopotamia, which is not true of like some of the political economists who are crucial to like left MMT, such as Michael Hudson, but it is true of some of the critical theorists around it. They talk about scarcity being a product of Franciscan definitions of poverty and that creating capital. And, you know, it's also a weirdly super idealistic and church-based reading that I think they mean metaphorically, but I'm not entirely sure. So there is this liberal historiography actually does have a seat at the table, not just in Whiggish socialist, but also in like modern monetary theory socialism. And most socialists, despite the fact they're of an educated class, don't know shit about history.
Yeah,
that's true.
Even recent history, but definitely not the broad scope.
Right. I mean, well, when people like try to convince me that you can base democratic socialism off FDR, I'm usually just like, well, you don't know anything about anything. I don't even have to take you seriously anymore. But like,
which is convenient in some ways.
which is also kind of narcissistic of me, but it is frustrating when you're like, do you understand what the New Deal actually did? Because you seem to be attributing to the New Deal a lot of new society and like late Eisenhower and Johnson projects, and B,
yeah,
while the New Deal did help a lot of working class people, it primarily stabilized the markets from their own collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and did so by providing jobs at the expense of wage growth. So
yeah. And like, really, like, when we look at what stabilized the American economy too, like, finally, it's not even the New Deal. It's war spending.
Yeah, it's war spending under the specific, and this is also important, under the specific conditions of us not being bombed.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's a military really
Keynesianism without any of the repercussions of being involved in war.
Right. And that is historically hyper rare, but that is how we became the richest nation on the planet. Literally, it is that.
we destroyed Europe and then we rebuilt it.
I mean, Europe destroyed itself and then yeah, we rebuilt it.
But I mean, we helped a little.
I don't know. Like, I'm looking. I have to read this book about the bombing campaigns. Mm. And like, we destroyed Europe. Like, the British and the American air forces destroyed Western Europe. And then the Germans destroyed Eastern Europe. But yeah, like, the main centers of production in Germany and a lot of the occupied countries were just completely decimated.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
By the American and British Air Force.
That I know. I mean, yeah, yeah. So it's interesting because I think when as we unpack these Wickham essays, and particularly when we focus in on the actual historical argument for the transition in Western Europe in late antiquity, and particularly when we discuss his feudal revolution thesis, I think we're going to see how there is actually some usefulness to the parallels between our current moment and the end of antiquity, because we are seeing a lot of systems reach net energy capacity in a lot of ways. And we're seeing a lot of systems reach maximum inequality and still be stable. Yeah. We've reached, a lot of systems that have hit hyper complexity, like you saw at the end of the Roman Empire, which is one of the reasons like it collapsed. Its administrative apparatus in the centralized state was too fucking complex for anybody to actually run.
Right.
And too energy and too costly to maintain.
Well, that helps explain a lot of like people's, you know, fervent religious belief in algorithms and automated planning, because there is an implicit recognition that we're in a similar place. In a vastly complex society that human beings can't really get their heads around. But maybe the computers could do it for us, I don't think so, but that's what people really want to believe.
The computers can do what we program them to do.
Right. And maybe and a little less than that, actually.
Right. But it's always interesting, because while the capacity for linear processing in a computer way outstrips the human brains, its motive and directive is totally decided by both us and the social social context in which we put those computers to work in. So if we don't see a way to out of the problem, then I don't know why a computer would, because we are programming its parameters. And you know, it's interesting where this limitation has shown up in modern reporting. They're like, well, the computers are racist. And I'm like, yeah, because all the inputs were a certain kind of person. Fine. But if you see that problem there, wait till you see what else that implies about everything else you've been inputting into these computer algorithms.
Yeah.
Like, why are the computer algorithms making you dumber? Well, they're giving you exactly what you want.
Yeah.
It's a
complete feedback loop. Yeah.
Right.
Feedback loop. It's a confirmation bias. Exactly right.
Yeah. So, if you think that your social media is stupid and bad,
unfortunately,
take a look at yourself.
You might be
like, everyone on all of my friends list, on all of my social media platforms is an idiot. And I'm like, well, dog. No.
Yeah. I do think we also have to be honest that there's a way in which they incentivize idiocy, but like,
yeah, absolutely.
But I also agree with you. If like there's nothing redeeming on your social media, part of the problem is you.
Yeah.
But we also have to think that like some of these desires, some of these aggregate deliveries are aggregate. They're not individual. Ironically. So right,
they shape us. They shape us too. It's not like it's not purely you feed a version of yourself into it and it translates back to you. And so if it sucks, you suck. It also shapes you. It makes you suck more.
Right. It is a negative dialectic. A negative feedback loop. But it is one in which you cannot deny your social culpability. It's, for example, when we complain about alienation, and I do a lot, but we have to admit that a lot, like, even religious people, like, let's be honest. I don't love the J.D. Vance book, Hillbilly Elegy, but I actually did like that it was honest about a few things about, like, working class conservative people. Like, they say they go to church, but that's totally aspirational. They really don't. They're really at home watching porn. Like, I mean, and that was that was what I saw in real life. So like,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, and you think about it, like, how are these evangelical churches being captured by QAnon? Well, because they have no theological literacy whatsoever. They're literally maintaining themselves by delivering exactly what people want and not as any authoritative cultural transmission mechanism. So they're all heretics from a classical Christian perspective. Like,
absolutely.
To the last. And
worshippers of Mammon.
Right. Or not even. Like, that might be too consistent for some of this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these people are heretics from that whole branch of mammon worship that is the national religion of the United States. They're heretics of that.
Right.
Yeah, it's a long slide downward.
But I also, to talk about this time period, this is a time period where we see a lot of those kinds of movements. So we actually probably see even more of them in the third century.
Mm-hmm.
Like the third century in Rome is wild with mystery cults and apocalyptic religions and like weird quasi-synthetic ethnicities coming out of nowhere and like...
And just about as many versions of Christianity as exist now existed at the very beginning of when it started to coalesce into orthodoxy and...
If you want comparative religion to comparative imperial religion to compare Christianity to is Buddhism, which never coalesced because this imperial structure in the Indian, the proto-Indian, actually, you call it Indian's a little bit misleading, but in the
whatever the subcontinent is at the time,
the various subcontinent empires never coalesce in the same way. So you have radical theological divergence on a theme, you know, and then it does, when Buddhism does manifest in other places, it picks up a whole lot of the cultural apparatus thereof. And so Buddhism's an even more diverse religion than Christianity, but those are the two probably most diverse religions.
And yeah, Christianity, the versions of Christianity that develop on the other side of the divide between Christianity and Islam. Like there are a myriad of forms of Christianity that are considered heretical that the Muslims didn't care about. So they're just like, yeah, you guys are Christians, whatever. So like, you know,
there's a reason why it's not just Jews, but like Syriac Christians, Judaizing Christians, quote unquote, Monophysites, like the Ethiopian and Egyptian Coptic Church.
Churches.
Which I pretty much think they weren't really Monophysites actually, but whatever.
Miaphysite is the
Miaphysite,
politically correct term. Monophysite is the slur.
But I actually don't think they're even guilty of that. I think it's actually a translation error between Coptic and Greek. Regardless.
That's interesting. I'm not familiar with that.
But because like if you actually listen to the differences between Orthodox theology and the Oriental Orthodox churches versus the Eastern Orthodox churches is like rules about marriage where they resemble the Catholics. And they actually do not disagree on like the right way to say the Apostles' Creed and all that. Like it's actually quite interesting.
There's no filioque controversy.
No, there's no filioque controversy, nothing like that. And the consubstantiation problem goes away if you translate some things differently. So there's actually language problems. But what's interesting is the Chaldean, which is both Eastern and Roman, attacks on the Oriental church actually lead to them being totally copacetic to the Muslims coming in and stopping Roman imperial persecution of different kinds of Christians.
Right. There's a number of instances where it's Eastern Christians who are considered heretical by the Byzantine state, who sort of like opened the gates and let the Muslims in.
Right. I mean, it happened more than once. And so it's sort of an interesting problem. And it's also one of these things where the whole base and superstructure, if you have a nuanced understanding of that metaphor, it's super helpful. If you have a very simpleton's understanding of that metaphor, you're not going to understand any of this.
Yeah.
Like, because you're like, well, but why? You know, this religious stuff shouldn't matter at all. And I'm like, yeah, but there's ethnic and political and administrative and economic. All these things tie into these divisions. Like, none of these are purely just theological.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, of course, this is an oversimplification of it. But behind every single split or heresy that gains steam and actually has some social weight to it, you're going to find an administrative or a political or an economic, you know, reason that underlies it, you know?
Well, the biggest one that's obvious that everybody knows about from grade school is Martin Luther and indulgences.
Yeah. Yeah.
most of the other separations between Catholic and between Catholic and Protestant theology actually come after the split.
Martin Luther doesn't decide that he actually gives a shit about transubstantiation versus consubstantiation, the books of the Bible, the justification by grace alone. You know, that all of that stuff happens after he's considered a heretic, and the church wants to burn him.
Right. And if we're honest, we were already talking about factions that are deemed later heretical, but were totally okay, like a few centuries before, that had the same beliefs on most of those questions. Like,
well, so the Monophysite versus like Orthodox heresy isn't that based on like the idea that the Monophysites believe that the human nature is like a drop of honey in a bathtub. The human nature of Christ is like a drop of honey in the bathtub, whereas like the Orthodox Christian version is that Jesus had equal human and godly nature.
The division is like, it's like the drop of honey in the bathtub versus not equal, but fully both.
Fully both, yeah. I mean, not equal, but fully both, yeah.
But the funny thing is, when you actually listen to modern Coptic and Ethiopian Orthodox, or Armenian Orthodox too, explain the difference, they actually also believe in the fully both. Yeah. So it was a difference in wording based on language translations. Because the Greek, Coptic Greek have been influenced by Coptic, and while it's written in Greek, traditionally written in, although now it's written in Arabic letters.
Yeah, it's a Semitic language, right? So
it's Semitic language, but it was written at the time in Greek letters.
Yeah.
So it was weird. It's Semitic, Afro-Asiatic language that's like kind of related to, it's related to ancient Egyptian, but that would make it more related.
That's its closest relative, right?
Yeah, to like Amharic, an Ethiopian, than it would like modern Hebrew or Syriac or any of that. But still, it's like got that similar verb structure and all that. But it was written in, was not written in characters designed for it. Like the Coptic Demotic had been abandoned for a modified Greek alphabet with some demotic hangovers for sounds that didn't exist in Greek by that time. But this led to chaos, right? And so, okay, so in this one example, we have a religious division coming out of a cultural distinction that is based on political divisions related to language translation based on former empires manifesting in current ones. Yeah. Like these are mutually reinforcing feedback loops. They are, and I'm using this language to avoid the mystification, but they're also dialectics, like from the Hegelian sense. But you'll see me go back and forth between talking about feedback loop and systems that normal people understand and speaking Marxology, because I actually think they're effectively the same thing.
I think it's important that we demystify dialectics by explaining what it means and, continually basically doing what you're doing right now and referring back to things as dialectical and then explaining what that means. It's because it is the case that it's a dialectical has been a weird hand wave from the high Stalinism era through the decline of global communism as a project, but that's a mistake. And that's definitely not one that we ought to presume will stay,
It means it's either a mistake or it's just a lie.
Well, it's
a way of waving away something you don't want to think about too hard.
Yeah. If you think about the Shanghai, it's the Canton massacre when the nationalists turn on the communists and kill everybody. And that pushes the communists into the countryside. Communist historiography at the time, and for a while since, was like, well, that was a dialectical completion, a dialectical leap, and it was basically a historical necessity. It's like, no, you just are a bad strategist. Like, dialectics doesn't just explain everything you want to explain.
Like, you were a bad strategist, and then Mao took over, and whatever you can say about Mao,
he's a good strategist. They would talk about it in ways of being dialectical. Let's try to figure out how to be dialectical. That's not what it means.
No.
Right.
Things are dialectical. History is dialectical, and you exist in history. So you're being dialectical by existing. But it's not something to deploy, it's not like being a really good football player.
And fact that it's so mystified leads to the equally asinine counter to that being the analytical Marxists who think there's no such thing as dialectics.
Yeah. I feel like that makes it a lot harder to understand the stuff we've been talking about here. Like, you know, what's the distinction between the end of the high Middle Ages and the beginning of the early modern period? Not the high Middle Ages, the late Middle Ages.
You know what's actually funny about that? Like, if you read J.A. Cohen, J.A. Cohen actually maintains the kind of simple Stalinist modes of production historiography in his theory of history, which he turns against later. But like in the first draft of A Defense of Marx's Theory of History, he's basically defending the vulgar Stalinist forms of modes based off of dialectics, but in a rational choice model, which I think is hilarious because he's basically he brackets out relations of production solely for modes of production as if modes descend from nothing. And that is why, I mean, that's why I think a lot of like the post-structuralists rejected Marxism, because the way that the structuralists, and I don't hate all structuralists, like Wickham actually uses two of the worst offenders of anti-historiographic structuralists to make a good point. So they're not useless.
Which ones are those?
Henders and Hendris.
Oh, okay.
They're the people that E.P. Thompson specifically points out as like the worst form of altruism that he was fighting against. But
well, it's funny. Wickham is constantly just pulling like gems out of like garbage analysis. You find that whenever you read his larger works as well.
But the structuralists end up having the same problems because they just start seeing modes. Modes just exist. It actually does lead to like Foucault thought, where you're like, there aren't transitions. There's just epistemes. Right. Have a nice day. Like, like.
It's very comforting, you know. But wrong.
Right. Well, I mean, it's weird also when like some of Foucault's work is literally trying to literally explain transitions, and then he's like, but that's not important. Thank you. Why it happened, how it happened, that's not important. It's just that there are different, you know, archaeologies and epistemes to deal with. And I'm like, that's not explanatory at all. Good old Foucault, your power relations theory like avoids how they emerge and makes them seem, it makes it also seem like, I mean, this is the irony. We've talked about the Marxist modes, and then we've talked about the liberal tendency towards viewing things as similar now, but there also is the converse liberal tendency developing them out of liberal approximations of Foucauldianism, where like social epochs are completely sui generis and don't overlap really at all. Like, right. You know, some schools of new historicism, like you can't talk about this, you know, there's no such thing as sexuality until this time period. And like, and there's no continuity between sexuality between this and this time period. Like, it's a different power bio relation. And how did it change? That's not our problem, and we don't care.
Right. Like, and like, when was that turning point? Like, where's the moment where one ends, the other begins? And if you're actually trying to identify that, you can't.
And Foucault's early work, he actually does try to, but eventually he just says these are discrete things. Yeah. And what I think is this idea of revolutionary transition, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I also think is, which I think political Marxists get a little bit iffy with, because you're also saying that like, well, the distinction between reform and revolution is actually maybe not one of kind.
No, I think
it's one of
degrees.
Three. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I like the idea that a full socialism, like in the Austro-Marxist sense, is it's revolutionary and reformist, depending on the political demands of the moment in history that you live in. But you don't get to go be a reformist separate from the revolutionaries and vice versa. To the extent that you try to, you actually make artificial divisions in the workers' movement. Not every single moment is an insurrectionary moment, but insurrectionary moments are not democratic ones. You know, they're just, right. They're not. You don't advance a bill when the government's collapsing around you.
Yeah, so it's kind of a waste of energy.
Yeah.
Cough, 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 cough.
What is everybody hoping to get out of this discussion we haven't had yet?
Out of this discussion? I'd say, like, we introduced what we were going to talk about, and then we never actually talked about it, but we did tie it into a lot of other things that we think are important and that will be affected by it. The subject once we get around to it.
Yeah, this was the only thing we actually talked about was a comparison in tax policy between the Charlemagneans and the Abbasids, which is like I'm gonna pour important, like the most obscure point from this text and make it the one thing we mention in our introduction to the text. So what I would say is there's no royal road to Rome except the one that we do next episode.
Yes.
There you go.
So, next episode, all roads lead to Rome.
Right. All roads lead to Rome and then out of Rome into the abyss. But
out of Rome and into the darkness of the early dark ages, right? Quote unquote.
And I think now that you've seen why we think this is important, what the ways this rhymes, we can now just focus in on this one argument with three writings from this one Marxist historian and historiographer. And I'm also going to insist that we not mix up history and historiography because I hate when Marxists do that.
Yeah.
And we're going to really kind of pull out what we think we see in this. And then we'll come back. And who knows how many episodes, because I'm not going to predict that. Who knows? To a conversation like we started with and start retying into the modern world. So today was the throwing the spaghetti against the wall. But at least we know what the sauce is.
Yeah.
Yeah, nicely put. I actually think that's exactly right.
It makes it sound like we meant to do this.
Yeah, there you go.
Totally. Yeah. All right, and we'll end there. This has been No Royal World with Varn and the Brothers Regrettable. This is a joint project, and for those of you who are listening, this will be released to both feeds. So, yay.
Listen to it on both.